Thank you. I first spoke to the Philadelphia Society in 1967 in a panel with Ed Fulmer and Mike Uhlman in San Francisco. And I had been introduced to it by Gerhard Niemeyer. When I was asked to speak here today, I was humbled, thinking that I would be filling the role of my mentor, Robert Strauss Juppé, in foreign affairs. I would have relished that role, or perhaps I might have been asked to speak on comparative government, comparing the American regime to others, the French Revolution, modern regimes, whatever. Instead, I was asked, and Patrick Deneen got that job, instead I was asked to speak about the road ahead in politics, a job which was done 50 years ago by Frank Meyer. And Frank Meyer, well, those who knew him knew what a redoubtable person he was, and so you can imagine how humbled I am, and I should hope that I can do okay in that regard. So, having been asked to point to the road ahead in politics, called to mind the best short advice I ever heard on that subject. It was the beginning of Brent Bozell's exordium at the 1962 YAF convention at Madison Square Garden. Quote, "When we know ourselves, we will know our mission, and the orders will go out." Then details some orders. In short, which of the roads ahead of us we take should depend on an accurate assessment of who we are, where we set out to go a half century ago, of our successes and failures, and of what stands in the way in our way of getting there. Who are we? Well, we are the successors of the folks who listened to Barry Goldwater in 1960 as he bid us to grow up and take over the Republican Party. The reformed Republican Party was to be the political tool by which we would reverse or at least stop the transformation that Franklin Roosevelt's Democratic Party was inflicting on our beloved United States of America. A transformation that the Republican Party, as it existed then, had no intention of stopping. So we took Goldwater at his word. We gave hell to the Rockefeller Republicans and enjoyed ourselves. Dave Duval was a partner of mine in that enterprise in New Jersey. For that, we were called the Rat Finks, and we enjoyed ourselves thoroughly. We built a movement. And within three short years, victory was in our grasp. We were ahead in the polls. But before we could nominate our candidate, John Kennedy spoiled it all by getting himself killed by a commie, and we got blamed. And we will never, ever forgive John F. Kennedy for that. Undaunted by the ensuing social revolution, and galvanized by Ronald Reagan's speech on the 27th of October 1964, we placed him at the head of our movement, continued on the path that Goldwater had indicated for us, namely, build a political movement with intellectual and moral substance worthy of the men of 1776 to 1789. These are the people who gave us our country. Use the Republican Party, the reformed Republican Party, as our tool. Save America. Meanwhile, Richard Nixon's Republicans were giving us, among other things, the EPA, affirmative action, wage and price controls. They cut the dollar's last link to gold, and his judges were giving us Roe versus Wade. Well, we were not daunted. 34 years ago, we elected Reagan. But the class of people, the governing structures, and the habits whom Franklin Roosevelt had foisted on America had become bipartisan, and they continued to grow. Within days of Bush 41's inauguration, Republicans, not Democrats, Republicans had swept Washington clean of Reagan's remnants. Today, as we look upon the movement that we built, a movement far larger than any of us imagined, and even though there are far more self-described conservatives in America than we ever dared hope, we are compelled to acknowledge that America is incomparably less conservative a country than it was a half century ago. I need not enumerate the practices, the kinds of persons that define our public and private lives today, or argue how nearly universally condemned they were 50 years ago when the Philadelphia Society first met. Nor do I have to argue to this audience that the persons and practices that are driving America further down this road are almost as firmly embedded in the Republican as in the Democratic Party. Fact is that the pretty good movement that we have built is less able than ever to affect America's main trends. That is because we lack a political vehicle, and we are not about to get one. Today, about 4/10 of Republican congressmen and about 2/10 of senators are conservative. Some 3/4 of Republican voters are conservatives. But the Republican Party is at least as hostile to prying loose progressivism's grip on America as it ever was. It does not want to displace the progressive ruling class, but to join it. That ruling class is bipartisan, and because of that, our movement is ever more surrounded by forces that are ever more hostile to it with every passing day. Therefore, we cannot expect to reach our objective by following the road that got us where we are today. We cannot, after good drinks and good fellows, go back to our educational and organizational activities, go once more into the breach of the Republican primaries, confident that we will save America thereby. Such activities, good and necessary in themselves as they are, have proved insufficient. Let us be clear about what we are up against and what our real political options are. In a nutshell, America is in the grip of a bipartisan ruling class that is powerful, pervasive, attractive, and driven. Its cultural, political, and economic hegemony attracts new generations and marginalizes, bends, or crushes its resistors. Already, we have a post-Buckley National Review and a post-Bartley Wall Street Journal. They supported the TARP. With every passing year, they tack more and more to the prevailing social winds. If the past 50 years' trends continue, it will take a lot less than 50 years for the America that we set out to preserve to become a despised memory. Conservatism itself is being defined right out from under us, as our bipartisan ruling class increasingly defines it in terms of acceptance of its own hegemony. And it defines most Americans in terms of one or another phobias. We are sick and described as in need of either shunning or treatment or both. And let no one have any doubt that if present trends continue, it will be increasingly more difficult for heads of corporations, for individuals to contribute to the kinds of organizations that have formed the conservative movement over the past 50 years. These groups will be starved and shunned and either made to change or simply will be eliminated. In the absence of political representation, in the absence of a political force that contends with the ruling class, we, along with the majority of Americans, are going to be squeezed into acceptance of the ruling class's cultural hegemony. In this regard, let us be mindful of communist theoretician Antonio Gramsci, who taught modern totalitarians that hegemony over culture is the fruit of political power, and that hegemony over culture, in turn, ensures political power against challenge. So knowing that, we are compelled to note that our choice is between, on the one hand, accepting the ruling class's hegemony, or on the other hand, creating a political force to challenge the ruling class's political oligopoly. Who represents whom politically, and for what purpose is the practical key? The practical key is who represents whom politically, and for what purpose? The Democratic Party represents those who run it, run, staff, vote for, and benefit from the U.S. government. It represents their economic interest and their preferred way of life. It coalesces its components, groups into a class, and stokes their sense of self-worth by denigrating outsiders. The benefits of fellowship with that class are such that pursuing membership in it is the practical objective of countless ambitious Americans, including leading personages of the Republican Party, notably including them. So, as the Democratic Party has grown its constituent parts into a massive complex of patronage, its near monopoly of education has endowed its leaders ever more firmly with the conviction that they are as entitled to deference and perquisites as they are entitled to power. Administrators and teachers at all levels of education have taught two generations that they are brighter and better educated than the rest of Americans, whose objections to the schools and to the party's prescriptions need not be taken seriously. That party rules, to use the New York Times columnist David Brooks' characterization of Barack Obama, quote, as a visitor from a morally superior civilization. The party bolsters its own cohesion by accusing the rest of America of a familiar litany of moral and intellectual inferiorities and pathologies. You all know them very by heart. Racism, sexism, et cetera, homophobia, you name it, you know it. 3/4 of Democratic voters approve of the Democratic Party largely for that reason. Only 1/4 of Republican voters approve of their party for that very reason. Why should they? Why should Republican leaders do not defend their voters against the Democrats' litany? Rather, they tend to set themselves apart from their own base after the fashion of the Pharisee in the temple. Lord, I thank thee that I am not like other Republicans. The Republican Party never fully adapted itself to the fact that modern big government is an interest group at odds with the rest of society, that government creates a demand for representation by those it alienates, and hence that politicians must choose whether to represent the rulers or the ruled. The Republican Party had been the party of government between the Civil War and 1932. But then, in those years, government was a smaller thing. It did not aspire to shape the lives of the ruled. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal largely shut these Republicans out of the patronage and power of modern government. So, by the late 1930s, the Republican Party had become the default refuge of voters who did not like where Roosevelt's new big government was taking them. So, the Taft wing of the party took on the role of defender of the outs. Meanwhile, the Rockefeller wing of the party tried to compete with the Democrats as brokers of privilege. But corporations, finance, and the entitled high and low, Americans' inns, gravitated to the Democrats' permanent power. Meanwhile, the outs fled into the Republican fold. So, one of the party's wings represented people who wanted to rule, while the others represented people who didn't want to be ruled, and who wanted the protection from the rulers. One part was for folks who wanted in, the other part was for folks who wanted out. Obviously untenable. In 1960, Barry Goldwater brought this out for everyone to see and began the revolt of the Republican Party's outsider constituents. This led to his nomination for president in 64. The Republican establishment maligned him far more violently than did the Democrats, far more. Ronald Reagan was similarly maligned. Overcoming the Republican Party's maligning and opposition was far easier than winning the presidency with 2 landslide elections. But Reagan never resolved the question, who or what does the Republican Party represent? That's because his interlude was brief. And then the Bush dynasty, plus the congressional leadership, behaved indistinguishably from Democrats. Behaving like Democrats suits the interests of Republicans who are associated with big business, who want special treatment from government. But they do not want at all the interest of voters who want to control their own lives and to counter cultural assaults on their way of life. Republican leaders have reasoned that such voters, quote, have nowhere else to go, unquote. They have been content to get just enough of these voters to, quote, hold their nose, unquote, to win enough elections so as to secure their own place at the ruling class's table of plenty. Having erased any reason why anyone ought to trust any Republican, qua Republican, they refused to notice that voters were lending their votes out of allegiance to causes rather than to the party, and that Republican candidates increasingly sought votes through the medium of groups that advocate the voters' causes rather than through the party label. And so the Club for Growth has become a surer standard of economic probity than the Republican National Committee. No surprise there. The several pro-life organizations have spread enough knowledge of embryology and moral logic to make Roe versus Wade, which is the ruling class's major, proudest accomplishment, into a shrinking island within American jurisprudence and society. All of this despite the Republican Party's, well, let us say, lip service at best. The countless Tea Parties have added their countless attendees to networks of information and organization, despite efforts by Republicans as well as Democrats to demonize them. The same goes for evangelicals, gun owners, Catholics. Though such groups represent the country class fragmentarily, it is these groups, not the party, that now represent opposition to the ruling class. That is because these groups actually stand for something, because they represent their adherence against the ruling class's charges and insults. Thus, the Republican leadership finds itself in a position analogous to that of Episcopal bishops. They own an august label and increasingly empty pews because the faithful priests and congregations are fending for themselves elsewhere. We can understand our road ahead, and to the extent that we understand this political reality of our time. The Republican Party has been dead for years. The closer someone is to it, the more he smells of corruption. What then? Is it time for a third party? Well, Margaret Thatcher, as Margaret Thatcher would say, no, no, no. Rather, it is time to take the Taft, Goldwater, Reagan soul out of that rotten Rockefeller Romney body and to place it into a living instrument of American renewal. That conflicted cadaver cannot represent the American people. One might add, neither can the nattering nabobs of negativism. It adds no value to our struggle to recover the rule of law, economic freedom, elementary decency, and a common defense. When parties become incapable of dealing with the challenges of their time, people rightly and necessarily walk away from them. This, of course, is what happened to the Whig Party after 1850. After party leaders Henry Clay's last great compromise had sold the party's principal cheap, the most vigorous Whigs, William Seward, governor of New York, John Fremont, later joined by an obscure Illinois ex-congressman named Abraham Lincoln, he had nothing going for him except he kind of talked well, looked for another vehicle for their cause. In 1854, they joined with representatives of other groups to found the Republican Party. As my friend Bruce Colbert never ceases to remind us, this was not a third party. Rather, it was, quote, one party that transitioned into another. The healthy parts of it did the transition, the parts of it that could still walk, that still had some credit. In 1854, the Whig Party's leaders had made that abandonment almost inevitable when they undercut their own compromise of 1850. By lending their votes to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, they theoretically removed any restraint on the extension of slavery. Had Seward and others remained Whigs, they would have lost any credibility regarding slavery or anything else. Instead, they went into a little schoolhouse with the Free Soilers, the Americans, the abolitionists, and they came out Republicans. Hundreds of Whigs, as well as some Democrats, joined them, so that by 1856, hardly anyone admitted to having been a Whig. The Whigs had said too many things too long that did not mean. Nobody wanted to hear anything more from them. I wonder how many people take the Republicans seriously and ask, what will actually happen if the Republicans have power to do what they said? Will they do it? They will bet not. Today's Republicans, are in the same position. They've talked loudly of opposing Obamacare while joining Democrats in funding it, while denigrating Republicans who did not fund it. Their excuse was that they did not have a majority in the Senate. Give them that majority, they brayed and continue to bray, and they would surely be champions of ordinary Americans, just like with Lucy in the football, next time for sure. It seems that by the 2014 elections, they may very well have such a majority in the Senate. By then, Obamacare's financial unviability will surely be forcing the insurance companies that helped to craft it to suffer grievous losses or to raise premiums for millions of Americans. Just as surely, these companies will demand a bailout. Of course, President Obama and the Democratic Party will demand that such a provision be included in the annual continuing resolution on pain of a veto and a government shutdown. How many people think that the Republican Party will object? And how many think the Republican leadership will vote to pass such a provision and keep Obamacare alive? I'll take bets. Any person who does not abandon the Republican Party after the Republican Party votes once again, as it has in the past, will have sacrificed what remains of its credibility, just as surely as did the Whigs who failed to revolt after passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Causes for abandoning the Republican Party having piled up for decades, occasions for that abandonment to occur will not be lacking. Thus, we may be certain that the 2016 presidential election cycle, Republican leaders will be acting as they have for half a century. They will vilify conservative challengers to the ruling class one by one, until only such people as Dole and Bush and McCain and Romney are left. Can we then imagine the Club for Growth, the NRA, the various pro-life organizations, the panoply of issue organizations that increasingly have represented and defended their constituents? Can we imagine the members of the Philadelphia Society upon the nomination of the nth Republican turkey holding their noses for the nth time and supporting that turkey? It seems more reasonable, at least to me, to hope that well before the next casus felderis occurs, the Republicans, who are today's equivalents of Whigs William Seward and Abraham Lincoln, will pre-plan responses to such events together with leaders of today's issue organization, the pro-lifers, who are today's equivalents of the 1850s abolitionists, the advocates of private property, who are the equivalent of the 1850s free soil movements, the religious groups, who are the equivalents of the 1850s revivalists. Some of us might be in the room as well. We would go into the meeting mostly as Republicans. We would come out the same people, but with an unsullied label. Federalists might not be a bad name. Just for the fun of it, consider this scenario. Circa January 1, 2016, the principal conservative issue groups, having decided to hang together lest they be hanged separately, meet with the top conservative contenders for the presidential nomination and advise them that if and when the Republican nomination is clinched by someone other than they, all these organizations will support someone who is willing to wage an independent campaign for the presidency. They will recall that in 1992, Ross Perot led the field, waging precisely such a campaign, and that had he not self-destructed, he would have won the popular vote. Clinton would have come in number two and Bush number three. With no one having won a majority of the electoral vote, the House of Representatives would have decided the election, with each state casting one vote. At that time, residual Republican allegiances would have been an obstacle for Perot. But now, a quarter century later, in 2016, the allegiance to the Republican Party is much weaker. Were there to be a three-way race between a Rand Paul or Ted Cruz, against Hillary Clinton and Chris Christie, the last will surely end up in last place. In the House, election of the conservative would be likely, and the end of the Republican Party would be certain. So, in the not-so-long run, a party led by conservatives who are already solid with their voters but are unencumbered by Republican baggage will be free to meet the natural yearnings that the American people have been expressing to pollsters increasingly for some years. Who then are we? We are the same folks who shared Barry Goldwater's and Ronald Reagan's passion for America. That passion was never essentially Republican. How the Republican Party treated Goldwater, Reagan, and all like ourselves who share that passion confirms that. Our identity, our passion, defines our mission. Our experience with the Republican Party confirms that it is not the road ahead for such as ourselves. And so the orders must go out. Convene meetings of persons who represent that passion in its various forms. Let those who enter call themselves what they will, but let them, as they come out, call themselves by a new name. Maybe Federalists would not be such a bad name. Thank you.